Chapter 2. There have always been researchers. They were called other things in ancient days. Sorcerers, healers, priests, witches, shamans, and sages. But they shared the same basic drives as modern-day scientists. They all wanted to understand how the world works and to use that knowledge to make human lives easier, safer, and more rewarding. The talented men and women who discovered how to make bread and how to build the ovens it baked in were doing a primitive sort of science. And so were those who coaxed the essences of plants from leaves and seeds and used it to cure ailments. And so were those who made the first wine, smelted the first metals, crafted the first bows and arrows, pressed paper, invented mathematics, preserved food, irrigated fields, tracked the stars, domesticated animals, and dyed cloth. All these breakthroughs, and many more, were made millennia before we had anything like what we now call science, a word that did not exist in its modern sense until the 18th century. Alchemists was a name applied to another group of early researchers. Alchemy's roots go back to ancient Egypt, to the search for life after death and the study of mummification. The practice evolved over time, but in a broad sense, it mixed primitive chemistry and observations made from metalworking with religious and philosophical ideas, all packaged in the form of a mystic quest. The goal of alchemy was to distill the pure soul of nature from the rough, chaotic stuff of the earth, to find the spirit hidden in matter. God was in everything, even the rocks, and alchemists believed their work was a way to understand the workings of the divine. They discovered that wonderful things happened when they heated certain substances with others. Sulfur, mercury, lead, salts, acids, plant extracts, metals, and minerals. Transformations took place. Things changed before their eyes, gave off strange odors, and took on new colors and forms. Vapors given off by heated liquids could be collected, condensed, studied, and mixed with other substances. Coagulated, dissolved, and repurified. At each step, the alchemists believed they were drawing closer to the spirit of the thing. The idea is still written into our language. The vapors given off by heated mashes of fermented fruits and grains, for instance, are condensed into what we call spirits. Their goal was to approach pure perfection on earth, to create in their primitive laboratories a divine substance capable of curing ills, conferring long life, and transforming base elements into gold. In the West, they called this the Philosopher's Stone. A similar search went on in the East, too, where Asian alchemists also sought an elixir of immortality, a mix of substances that could stop or reverse the aging process. In China, more than 1,000 years ago, an alchemist, engrossed in the search for immortality, stumbled across something that proved quite the opposite. While trying various combinations of substances, he ground up some sulfur, moistened it with honey, and then added a good portion of a white crystalline powder scraped from stone walls, most commonly those near garbage pits, barnyards, and graveyards. It was called a salt, although the word, which we now use to refer to table salt, sodium chloride, had a broader meaning in the old days, and still has a broader meaning for chemists. To the old alchemists, a salt was any sort of white crystal that had sapor, or a salty taste. The Chinese salt found on walls and used in this case was potassium nitrate. The ancients knew that different salts from different places had different properties and had worked them into a number of recipes for everything from preserving meats to making medicines. The Chinese alchemist heated his mixture and got a surprise. It blew up, shot out flames, and disappeared into smoke. News of his discovery quickly spread, and the formula for what the Chinese called huoyao, or fire drug, was refined and perfected by other alchemists. Honey was soon replaced with ground charcoal. It was fascinating to work with and dangerous. As early as the 9th century, a Taoist text noted that the alchemists' hands and faces had been burnt, and even the whole house where they were working burned down. But properly controlled, the fire drug was a powerful and useful tool. By mixing other ground minerals and metals into hua yao, Chinese alchemists found they could make flames of different colors, from deep blue to blinding white, making possible the first fireworks. The mixture could be put into a bamboo tube and attached to the end of a lance, then lit and thrust into the faces of one's enemies, making a terrifying weapon. It could be packed into paper tubes and lighted with a wick, the first firecrackers. Rammed into metal cylinders with a ball on top, it could hurl the ball across a field, the first cannons and muskets. Always, however, the most important ingredient making up three-quarters of the fire drug was the white salt. Without it, no fire drug could be made. By the late Middle Ages, the recipe had spread across the Middle East to Europe, where they found the same salt, which they called China snow or nitre, growing on stone walls, especially underground in basements and crypts. The Romans called it sal patre, Latin for salt of stone. That led to the most common name for the important salt, saltpeter. The Chinese huayao became the West's gunpowder. Gunpowder was the atomic bomb of its day. It changed the nature of war. Muskets loaded with it could destroy armies of armored knights. Cannons using it could batter stone castles into rubble. Gunpowder marked the end of the feudal age. By the 1500s, Europe was embroiled in an arms race with every nation seeking ways to make more and more gunpowder. Because every barrel of gunpowder required three-quarters of a barrel of saltpeter, access to saltpeter became a matter of national survival. The problem was that there was not a lot of it. Once scraped from stones and earth, it grew back, but with frustrating slowness. It took years to build up enough to warrant gathering. In England, by royal decree, the king's saltpeter gatherers, petermen they were called, scoured the countryside for the white salt. They quickly became among the nation's most reviled and feared public officials. Wherever they found saltpeter, the petermen were warranted to dig it out regardless of whose property it was on, regardless of the difficulties involved, even if it meant moving a privy, tearing apart a stable, or ripping up the floor of a house. Petermen opened pits, tore down walls, and commandeered carts and horses. They often took bribes. They could never find enough to please the crown. Naturally occurring saltpeter formed too slowly, too haphazardly, to supply a nation's needs. So ways were found to speed its growth. By the 18th century, the art and craft of the saltpeter plantation had been perfected, a way to hurry nature by creating an artificial environment for the rapid formation of saltpeter. A series of shallow trenches lined with clay, filled with a mix of soil, manure, garbage, and ashes, heaped into something that looked like a long burial mound and moistened with sewage and urine. After months of ripening in the sun, a crust of saltpeter would begin to grow out of the earth in the form of fine crystals that looked like tiny white flowers. A well-run plantation could produce every 2 years 5 or 10 pounds of pure saltpeter per cubic meter of dirt. It was painstaking, dirty, labor-intensive work, but it was necessary for national survival. In 1626, England's King Charles I commanded his subjects to carefully and constantly keep and preserve in some convenient vessels or receptacles fit for the purpose all the urine of man during the whole year and all the stale of beasts which they can save, to be donated to the saltpeter plantations. In Massachusetts Bay Colony, an act required every large farm to erect a nitre shed. In Sweden, farmers paid a portion of their taxes in saltpeter. It was still not enough. A few large natural deposits were found in caves, and the world was searched for more. Significant amounts were found in the rocky terrain of Spain, Italy, Egypt, and Iran. The mother lode of saltpeter, however, the only natural deposits in the world large enough to feed the gunpowder needs of an entire nation, was discovered in the mud flats of the Ganges in India, where it was believed that a combination of the river water, the hot climate, and the dung of holy cows combined to create a sort of huge natural saltpeter plantation. The British East India Company started shipping it to England by the ton in the mid-17th century. It was one of the company's most important cargoes. And this vital natural resource made India an especially important target for European colonial expansion. Saltpeter was a significant factor in the favor of the British takeover of India. What does gunpowder have to do with growing things? The answer came from South America, and the story goes like this. A small party of Indians during the time of the Spanish occupation in the 1700s was trekking from the Andes Mountains down to the village on the Pacific to do some trading. To reach the coast, they had to cross a wide strip of desert called the Tarapacá. Here, in the silent, eerie wastelands, they camped for the night, building a fire from dried cactus to keep warm. To their astonishment, the earth itself caught fire, with flames and sparks shooting up from the ground around the fire. They thought it was the work of the devil. They ran. When they returned the next morning to gather their things, one of the group, a woodcutter named Negriorus, gathered some of the earth from the area of the fire. This he dutifully brought to a nearby mission and gave to a priest, along with a description of the events of the night. The priest knew enough about chemistry to ascertain that the chunks of earth were rich with a kind of salt, a mineral similar to the saltpeter used in gunpowder, although not as powerful. It was sort of an inferior saltpeter, not the true saltpeter, the sort found in India and China used for gunpowder. Still, it was capable of catching fire. He assured the travelers that the devil had nothing to do with their experience. Then he threw the rest of the sample out. Some weeks later, the priest noticed that the vegetation growing around the spot where he had thrown the devil's dust was greener, taller, and more luxuriant than the other mission plantings. He told this interesting fact to a visiting British naval officer. At this point, two things happened, according to the legend. One was that a small local industry grew up to refine the desert saltpeter to be sold for use in fireworks and gunpowder. It was not a perfect substitute for China's snow. True saltpeter was rare in South America, but the Spanish found that the inferior local salt was at least good enough to make a cannon fire. The other was the beginning of the idea that a salt from the desert might have use as a fertilizer. No one knows how much of the legend is true. What is known through historical records is that by the early 19th century, at least two scientists had visited the area of the Tarapacá and written of the properties of the local saltpeter, which the natives called salitre. The French had started importing some to make gunpowder. Interest in the South American saltpeter was lower in Britain, where the crown controlled the world's richest stocks of high-quality true saltpeter in India. But a few bagfuls of the South American variety had reached the area around Glasgow, where farmers found that adding it to their fields increased their crop yields. Enough was known about it to vaguely interest a young British divinity student in the summer of 1835. His name was Charles Darwin. He was standing on the deck of a small surveying brig, HMS Beagle, riding the swells at anchor in one of the few sizable bays to be found on the bleak 1,000 miles of coastline that stretched up the west coast of South America from its southern tip to its Spanish holdings in Peru. He was eager for something, anything new. Week after week, as the ship had rounded the horn and sailed slowly northward, he had seen little but dry brown hills. Now, after endless days of tacking, he was completely bored by the repetitious, often vegetationless coastline. The coast was here formed by a great steep wall of rock about 2,000 feet high, Darwin wrote dutifully in his notebook. The rocky hills, for the most part, rose directly from the sea, leaving little room for inhabitants. Not that the area could support many humans anyway. The sea was beautiful here and full of life, but the land was as arid and uninviting a stretch of desolation as Darwin had ever seen. A few scattered Indian tribes survived by fishing, but the hills for hundreds of miles were so rugged, the flat areas near the water so rare, the sources of fresh water so few, that he felt he was looking at a near-perfect desert in both senses of the word, dry and empty. The Beagle was anchored in the bay of one of these small fishing villages, the only one for leagues with a harbor of any size, a place called Iquique. He was ready to stretch his legs. He had heard stories about the interior, about a strange local industry practiced on the other side of the hills, and he wanted to see it in person. A voyage around the world in 1835 generally took 2 to 3 years. Darwin's time on the Beagle would stretch to 5. 5 years with a few dozen uneducated companions in a small floating box, facing months of tedium punctuated by moments of terror, could sometimes drive officers mad. A few years earlier, the captain of a previous voyage of the Beagle had committed suicide in the wastes of Patagonia. The Royal Navy did not want that to happen again. Darwin, young, energetic, well-schooled, interested in the nature of bugs and plants as well as the nature of God, had been taken on board as an unpaid gentleman's companion. He could take as many scientific notes as he liked, but his main job was to amuse the captain. Darwin's Aikikei notes give a sense of his mood after weeks of routine and tedium. "The aspect of the place was most gloomy," Darwin wrote. "The little port with its few vessels and a small group of wretched houses seemed overwhelmed and out of all proportion with the rest of the scene. The inhabitants are like those on board a ship. Everything comes from a distance. The village was nominally in Peru, not that it mattered much. The area had been ruled for thousands of years by scattered tribes, then for a time by the Inca, then by the Spanish, now theoretically by the new Republican governor of Peru. But the reality was that the Aikikei was so remote, so poor, so undesirable, that no one seemed to care much who governed it. To the west was the sea, to the east the high Andes. Far to the north was Lima, the great city of the Spaniards. To the south was a desert region, the Atacama, claimed by Bolivia. Somewhere beyond that, far to the south, lay another desert claimed by another of the new republics, Chile. The people of Aikikei referred to their own stretch of South America by its old Indian name, Tarapacá. What mattered in the Tarapacá in 1835 was not politics, but survival. It rained in Aikikei about once every 20 years. No crops could grow. Every drop of drinking water had to be shipped from a spring 40 miles away. Villagers in Aikikei bought it by the bottle, or when they could afford it, by the barrel. They survived only because their village perched on the edge of one of the world's richest fishing grounds. The great Humboldt Current, a giant river in the sea, rolled from Antarctica up along the west coast of South America, bringing with it a wealth of plankton, shrimp, and fish that fed local seals, natives, and millions of seabirds. The land here was dead, but the sea was teeming. On July 13th, the day after the Beagle anchored, Darwin hired an Aikikei guide to take him on a mule trip over the wall of rock and into the interior. It took them most of the first day to zigzag up a dusty trail to the summit. "Very tedious," Darwin wrote. The sun was setting by the time they topped the hills, and he saw what lay beyond. A wide plain of broken rock and low reddish hills spreading east all the way to the Andes, purple and white in the distance. There was not a tree in sight. There was not a blade of grass. The only sound was the sighing wind. This lifeless expanse, as barren as the surface of Mars, was the real Tarapacá. When most people think of deserts, they see the sandy dunes of the Sahara, scenes from Lawrence of Arabia, or perhaps the sagebrush and sandstone of a John Wayne Western. The Tarapacá is nothing like that. It is a blasted land, scarred and wasted, like something out of an uncomfortable dream. There is no sagebrush. There are no plants at all. As they rode through the dusk, Darwin could see bones and the skins of dead mules along the side of the trail, attended by a few vultures, the only local wildlife he would see on this trip. "This is the first true desert I have ever seen," Darwin wrote. The effect on me was not impressive. His attention was caught, however, by what looked incongruously like the remains of thawing snow, whitish patches scattered here and there across the desert. It was not snow, of course. Snow would mean water, and there was no water, but a thick layer of some whitish mineral. It had a salty taste. In some cases, it lay on top of the ground. In some cases, it dove under, buried under a layer of gravel and dirt. But the more Darwin looked, the more he saw. It was everywhere. "The quantity is immense," he wrote. He supposed that it might be the salty residue of a great inland sea that long ago had dried up. He and his guide took shelter as night fell in the house of a man who ran a small factory, an officina it was called, devoted to gathering and purifying the local salt. They were welcomed, given food, and a place to sleep. The whitish crust Darwin had seen on the desert, his host explained, was the source of the local saltpeter, the salitre. The raw deposit of salt, the thick whitish rock-like crust he had seen in the desert, was called caliche. In some places, the caliche was 4 or more feet thick. Darwin's host made his living by hiring workers, local Indians mostly, to find the best caliche, break it up, bag the chunks, load them onto mules, and bring them to the man's homemade factory. Here other workers crushed it, shoveled it into cow skins, and soaked it in water for a day. The water had to be packed in on muleback. Then they emptied the slurry into iron pots and boiled the contents over cactus fires. In some officinas, they added a beaten egg to the pot to help clean out impurities. The good part of the salt, the valuable part, Darwin's host explained, dissolved in the hot water, which was strained into clay pots to cool. The next day they could see a layer of crystals would form in the bottom and on the sides of the pots. This was what they wanted, the saltpeter they could sell, the salitre. They poured out the water, scraped out the salitre, and spread it on canvas to dry in the sun. It looked something like coarse table salt. This they bagged for a mule trip down to the port at Iquique. How long this had been done, no one really knew. There were legends about it, stories of Indian shamans who hid in the hills and made it during the time of the Spanish, stories of the Inca using it, but who knew? These days the salitre was used for many things. Some people, it was said, made soap with it, others fireworks, and now the Europeans were beginning to use it to make things grow. The salitre, Darwin learned, was what chemists called sodium nitrate. The people on the docks often called it simply nitrate. In Darwin's day, a 100-pound bag of nitrate packed by mule to the docks at Iquique sold for 14 shillings. He had seen enough. Darwin was more interested in living things than he was in primitive chemistry. His boredom allayed for a day, he jotted a few more notes, spent the night, and returned to the Beagle, eager for the next leg of his journey. A visit to what promised to be a more interesting port of call, a group of islands called the Galapagos.